Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From the file labeled "Even Randomness Has No Mercy," have you heard yet about the three asset managers from Greenwich who won the Powerball lottery? That's right, $254 million to be shared by the three as the poor get poorer and the 1% get 1%ier. Maybe that's why federal judge Jed Rakoff yesterday rejected a settlement between Citibank and the federal government for Citibank to pay a mere $285 million, barely a Powerball jackpot, for allegedly selling a mortgage investment fund to investors. A fund that was peppered with securities that Citibank thought would fail, so Citibank could bet against the fund, even as it promoted it to others. The judge said not a big enough fine to be a deterrent, and not forcing Citibank to admit wrongdoing, which avoids the Securities and Exchange Commission's mandate to get to the truth of such matters on behalf of the American people. So the 1%ers win the lotteries that aren't fixed and fix the ones they can. Randomness and intent both have no mercy. Judging from these two stories, Crain's New York business columnist and CUNY Journalism School Business Reporting Program Director Greg David joins us now with his views on this and Europe and America and his article yesterday on the four myths of holiday shopping. Hi, Greg. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. Good morning.
One could be forgiven for thinking randomness has no mercy and intent has no conscience. What do you think about Judge Rakoff's ruling?
Well, he's pretty unusual as a judge. He often goes where no one else goes, and that is what he has done here. It has been the practice for decades, and hundreds of federal judges have approved settlements like this in which a company pays a fine but doesn't admit or deny guilt. The reason for not admitting guilt in a case like this is that it would put the institution at great disadvantage in the civil lawsuits that usually follow settlements like this. So the judge, you know, I don't think the judge said the fine wasn't big enough. He said he couldn't determine whether the fine was appropriate because he didn't know what the real facts were. In doing so, he has overturned this longstanding precedent, and we'll have to see what everyone does. Will the SEC appeal because it is such a change of policy? Will the SEC just ignore it and assume the next judge won't rule that way? Many questions remain to be answered.
If the SEC appeals, then it puts the Securities and Exchange Commission, the regulators, on the same side as Citibank, the group that they sued for allegedly bilking its customers, and then they wind up on the same side, appearing to the public to argue for a slap on the wrist.
Well, you could argue that, but Brian, you're presuming that Citibank would be found guilty. And in fact, the Citibank probably has enormous defenses in a case, and the odds are heavily that Citibank won't be found guilty, and that's why the SEC acts this way. A trial will be incredibly costly, and the outcome is far from certain. So there are risks on all sides of this issue.
Well, let's talk about that, because there's an argument against the premise of the lawsuit, which is an investment firm can create an investment vehicle that it thinks will fail if there is a market of buyers who want to bet that it will succeed. Is that the argument?
Well, I don't want to go with that argument. You can argue it that way. You can. I would want to do a slightly different argument, and that is that everyone engaged in this transaction counts as a sophisticated investor. We had no one in this case who was an individual like you or me who Citigroup was calling up saying, buy this stuff. They were dealing with the most sophisticated people around. And by the way, these sophisticated people wanted all this subprime and toxic paper because they thought they were going to make a lot of money at it. So we're not dealing with a case where widows and orphans were getting taken advantage of by Citigroup.
New topic. On yesterday's show, New York Times economics columnist Paul Krugman said this about Europe.
I fire up my computer first thing in the morning to look at the interest rate on Italian bonds, and most days just give a little sort of eek and then want to hide under the table.
Do you also check European interest rates with your Cheerios these days?
No, I'm not quite that sophisticated, but the European debt stories are the first ones I read as soon as I go online or open my Kindle, that's for sure. Krugman's exactly right. Europe is a huge risk to the world economy, to another financial crisis, and to the American economy as well. It is incredibly dangerous for us all.
Today's lead story in The Times is about that crisis in Europe leading American banks now to tighten credit and a major cut in the projected growth rate in this country to 2% next year, down from 3.1% projections by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Does that change sound about right to you? That would downgrade U.S. growth by a third for next year because of what's happening in Europe. Does that sound right to you?
I'm not that pessimistic unless we have a European debt crisis that leads to a financial crisis. What's going on here is there's an enormous tug of war over what Europe should do, but what we really mean by saying what Europe should do about what Germany should do. Germany is the powerhouse economy in Europe. Should Germany and German taxpayers bail out the profligate economies of Greece and Spain and maybe Italy? Or should the Eurozone just fracture? Or should this plan of austerity, which has forced the profligate countries to get their economies into a place where they can afford their debts, work? If we stumble along, I don't really think that growth in the United States will be that diminished because the German economy is doing well, the dollar's not very strong, exports will be good. If all this leads to a crisis, then I think those projections are right or maybe even a little bit high.
Listeners, anybody want to call in for Greg David from Cranes and the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism talking about any of these economy stories, the SEC and Citibank versus Judge Rakoff, the European economy versus the American economy? We'll get to Greg's four myths of the holiday shopping business cycle. 212-433-WNYC. Anybody shop on Cyber Monday or Black Friday with mace in hand or however you shop? 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692. We'll try to touch on Greg's story yesterday about mixed signs in the New York real estate market. So the economy in general, fair game here. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, American Airlines parent company, declaring bankruptcy today, filing for, I guess it's Chapter 11. Do you see any path, Greg, to solvency for Europe that's better than others? The latest, just a few minutes ago on the wire from Brussels, says the 17 finance ministers of the countries that use the euro converged on EU headquarters today in a desperate bid to save their currency, discussing ideas that would have been taboo only recently, such as German Chancellor Angela Merkel reiterating her support for changes to Europe's current treaties in order to create a fiscal union. I have no idea what that means, but that's how the AP is reporting it. What does that mean, and do you see any path to solvency for Europe that's better than any others?
Well, let's start with what it means. What it means is turning Europe into the United States. For example, and we've talked a lot about how rich New York is and the 1% and all that. The worst economies in the United States are in places like Arizona, Florida, and Nevada. So what happens in this case is that enormous amounts of money leaves New York and goes to those places through federal government transfers in unemployment benefits, in Medicaid benefits, in other payments. So within the country, when one section of the country is hurt, the sections that aren't very hurt just send the money that way. And that's how we operate as a country. But they don't do that in Europe because they're sovereign nations. So that's what a fiscal union would be. It would be a place in which the rich took care of the poor, and also, to some extent, in which the the union would impose fiscal constraints. For example, the federal government can tell Nevada they can't have any more money or they can't borrow money and do things like that. So fundamentally, what that's about is turning Europe into some version of the United States, at least on economic and fiscal policy.
Interesting. So another Paul Krugman clip from yesterday, he explained why he does not think Europe's debt crisis should be taken as a cautionary tale for the U.S. to cut our deficit rather than spend more now to promote economic growth. Let's see how much you agree with this as he uses Sweden as an example.
It's the thing that we should most be worried about in the world today. It's terribly threatening. If their bank seizes up...
That's my error. That was a different clip of somebody else. So now here's Paul Krugman on Europe as not a cautionary tale for the U.S.
Look at Sweden, which, you know, famously has the most lavish, most extensive welfare state in the world. They're doing fine. The interest rate on Swedish bonds is like 1.6%. They have among the lowest borrowing costs in the world right now. What they have is they have their own currency, which turns out to be really important. All the countries that are in trouble are the ones that gave up their own currencies for the euro, and that turns out to be a real recipe for making yourself vulnerable. And they also have reasonably intelligent policymaking that doesn't get hung up on various notions of we must prioritize inflation fighting above every other economic goal. And so, no, if you look at who's in trouble, it's not at all correlated with who has big welfare states. And it's very strongly correlated with either being part of the Eurozone and or having unrealistic, hard-line, austerity-driven leadership.
Greg David, your reaction.
Well, it all depends on whether you think the fact the United States is headed to a position where our debt will equal 100% of our GDP at a time when China's ratio will be 12%, and whether you think that's something we can afford. It's all about whether you think the government should represent 25% of the American economy, the highest number since World War II, or it should head back to something more historically that we've had historically, which is about 20%. So I think those are the issues. But Krugman has definitely convinced me that the Eurozone is a terrible mistake. And if we could find our way to get from here to breaking it up, I agree that's the best solution. And the reason for that is, you know, it's one of the great ironies of what's happening in Europe is that the Germans are the big winner here. The Germans are you know, they recovered from the Great Recession faster than anyone except China. Their economy is booming, and the reason it's booming is they're an export-oriented country, and their exports are flooding Europe because they're in a stable currency. It doesn't cost any more to buy a German product in Greece than it does in Germany. But if Greece were an independent country with its own currency, that currency would be devalued. The cost of German imports would soar, and nobody in Greece would buy them. And then, by contrast, Greece is currently something like three times more expensive to visit than Turkey. But if they were on their own, their currency would depreciate, and we'd all go to Greece on vacation because it would be the cheapest place in the world.
Huh. So
the European zone has just made it impossible for countries like Greece to get out of trouble by devaluing their currency.
So the unlikely coalition of Paul Krugman and you would like to see the end of the euro. It sounds like Angela Merkel at this EU meeting in Brussels right now is arguing for an even stronger, more unified euro system.
Well, that's also possible. I mean, that's an economically reasonable alternative if countries in Europe are going to give up their sovereignty. I'm sort of skeptical that they will actually do that. The only difference, and I've been reading everything Paul Krugman's been writing since September, which is a lot, you know, considering how much he writes on his blog. But what I don't know, and I haven't seen him answer, is how we get from here to there. I mean, it's quite possible the breakup of the Europe creates another financial crisis like the one we saw in 08. None of us want that. The consequences would be disastrous. I understand about why an end to the Eurozone would be good for lots of people, wouldn't be good for the Germans, would be great for the Greeks, wouldn't be good for the people who hold the bonds, would be great for tourists. But I don't know how we get from A to B.
212-433-WNYC for Greg David. number of people calling in on Judge Rakoff, the federal judge, overruling the deal between the SEC and Citibank to settle the lawsuit against alleged fraud and selling toxic mortgage securities. Derek and Carl Place, you're on WNYC. Hi, Derek.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a problem with the guest's argument or the way that he would present it. I don't understand how sophisticated investors should be involved in toxic assets or debt or these toxic securities. Doesn't it affect everyone else if you're promoting this type of environment that it's okay, it doesn't make a difference, and that local banks are actually doing well because they're investing in our own communities right here? That's these huge banks investing all over the world. They're just throwing their money around and the power and weight around are affecting the average taxpayer here in the United States, I'm sure across the world.
Derek, thank you. Greg, do you understand the question?
Well, I mean, there are a couple different parts of it. All I'm saying is that Citibank was not taking advantage of widows and orphans. The people on the other side of the transactions knew that they were buying very risky housing securities. They knew that, and they wanted to buy them. I mean, they did want to buy them. Look, I'm not defending the way Citibank did it, just the way I wouldn't defend the way Goldman Sachs did what they did in the settlement that they made on a similar case like this. The issue that Rakoff has put on the table is it feasible to stop this system in which companies don't admit or deny guilt and pay fines? Does the SEC have the resources to prosecute these cases? And what would happen in courts? And, you know, we did that show in which Eliot Spitzer was on, and I would just like to remind people that for all of Eliot Spitzer's supposed sheriffs of Wall Street success, he did not convict a single person, and every time he went to court, he lost. The idea that Citi's going to lose here is another story.
He got some big settlements and forced companies to change some of their practices, right?
Right, but if those companies had challenged them in courts, we do not know what would have happened. And by the way, the Spitzer settlements, of course, did a lot to save us from the financial crisis, right?
Well, we don't know if it would have been worse. Valerie in Rybrook, you're on WNYC. Hi, Valerie.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I have a securities license for many years, and what we learn when we take our license and every year when you have your annual compliance review is that we have a fiduciary responsibility to our clients, which seems to elude the people at Goldman Sachs, of course. And so, you just said, you know, you're not defending those people, but if you have a fiduciary responsibility to a client, I fail to understand how you can sell them something that's toxic. Are they that you're betting against. I fail to understand how you can do that and preserve your integrity or your license or anything of that nature. Why aren't these people being losing their license, for example?
You have a fiduciary responsibility to sell something appropriate to your client, right?
Well, yes, but
we are talking about sophisticated.
Are you disclosing to them that it's toxic?
Well, the answer is that we didn't know whether it was toxic. It became toxic when the housing market collapsed.
Did they disclose that they were betting against it?
You know, there's a great debate about whether they should have to disclose whether they were betting against it. You know, we still haven't settled the issue as to whether Goldman Sachs was betting against its clients in a fundamental way or not.
Well, that's the case, though, in which Goldman paid twice as big a fine, about $500 million, if I remember correctly, for allegedly doing the same thing, although I guess the SEC didn't force them to admit guilt either. But they were allegedly selling these securities packages, mortgage securities packages, to investors that they were betting against without disclosing that they were betting against it.
No, that's actually not the case. The issue in the Goldman case was they allowed a money manager – who is going to bet against it, mm-hmm. to help select the securities in the package, and that's what they didn't disclose.
Right. Okay.
And the difference between the two cases, and I know it's sort of like pulling hairs here, is that in the Goldman settlement, Goldman did say it did not make sufficient marketing disclosures.
Well, if you have to disclose if you're making a market in any security, I don't understand why you don't disclose, you know, that you're betting against it. I fail to understand how we on a one-to-one basis when we're dealing with the public have to be so careful, and at that level that people seem to be getting away with murder.
Valerie, thank you. Greg, one more time.
I know somebody who works on Wall Street, and you know what? He won't do any business with Goldman because he doesn't trust them. Now, come on. I mean, so he's a sophisticated person, and he makes his decision, right? He's not alone. There are a lot of people who won't do business with Goldman. So it's not like it's exactly been a secret here that Goldman is the kind of traders they are. So I don't want to defend exactly what Citi did. I don't want to defend what Goldman did. I just want to point out that they were dealing with very sophisticated people who should have, on their own, made very careful assessments of what they were buying and why.
Greg David from Crain's New York Business and the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism, where he teaches business and economics reporting. We're almost out of time, but let's go quickly through your post yesterday called The Four Myths of Holiday Shopping. And I guess the biggest one that encompasses the others is Christmas as a business story is completely overhyped. You mean in general?
Yes, I mean in general. I mean, I've been doing a little poll since I wrote that and asking people what percentage of retail sales do you think Christmas represents, and they say things like a third or a half. In 2010, according to the Retail Federation, Christmas represented 19.4% of all retail sales. And that's, by the way, over a much broader period than we usually think of. Is Christmas important? Yes. Is it the only thing that's important to retailers? No.
But you say Black Friday, myth number one, is not the biggest shopping day of the year, and Cyber Monday as the biggest online shopping day is some publicists' fiction. But do you stand by those things despite the reports of all the shopping and buying the last few days?
Yes, it was a terrible example of journalists not digging deep enough. Black Friday can be the biggest shopping day of the year. It has the most traffic. It is not always the day the most money is spent. That is often the day before Christmas. Remember, a lot of people on Black Friday are looking. People the day before Christmas are buying. As for Cyber Monday, first of all, remember where it came from. Supposedly, we all went to work and bought because that's where our high-speed access lines are. Well, that isn't true anymore, right, either. But then it turns out that most years, Cyber Monday is the seventh to ninth biggest shopping day online every year. People who've really looked at this, and I did a whole bunch of searches to find the best stories on the subject, have looked into it. Now, you know, the journalists like to hype stories, right? It gets good headlines. It's what people expect to read.
What is the biggest cyber shopping day of the year? Is there a predictable one?
No, not as far as I was able to tell from my research. Maybe somebody knows better than I do. One year, the first year of the recession, it was number two. But I was sitting there yesterday listening to CNBC, of all places, just state it like it was a fact. It's just not. Now, they said that we sold $1 billion or $1.2 billion on Monday. We'll see if that's true, and then we'll see how it ranks when we get to the end of the year. But no, it's just it hasn't in the past been true.
Greg David from Crain's and CUNY J School, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we'll check in on why John Liu's campaign finances are under scrutiny as he presumably prepares to run for mayor of New York. And then we'll talk to Khalil Bird, the CEO of a new group as of this year called Americans Elect, that's trying to use an online nominating process to get a third presidential candidate to fight the Democrats and Republicans on the ballot in all 50 states. Stay with us.